talk about the dream and visions of Daniel's head, as it says in chapter 1. We talked about the fact that this is sort of, you know, this chapter opens a new epic, as it were, in the book. The first six being primarily the narrative of Daniel, of how God is using him in this historical kingdom, of his relationship to different kings. Now, this is revelatory. Of course, it harkens back to Daniel chapter 2, which I keep saying, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. He changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. And here it is right here. God is revealing deep and secret things, which we are finding out are, when God reveals, it's not always simple to understand what he sees and what he is ordaining as it is going on in history is not always in accord with our perceptions. And that's one thing to remember here, and I'm going to elaborate on this as we look at some parallel passages, is we're seeing such a small part of the picture that what's really going on in history isn't always just a matter of interpreting what we see. There are bigger things and more things involved in everything that we are seeing than we can really easily comprehend. And God is bringing us along, you know, revealing his purposes to us in Scripture. He's very, very clear on important truths that he communicates clearly and repeatedly. You know, probably the most obvious and simplest examples, you know, the Lord has made known to us that his Son has come as a man. He is God in the flesh. And we don't really understand everything about what it means to be God in the flesh, but it's repeated. It's over and over. It's clear. He hammers it home to us, as it were. And then he has things like, you know, 10 horns and one of them grows up and pulls out 3 by the roots. And it's not repeated over and over. It's not hammered home to us. It's not a central tenet of the faith. It's not unimportant. I don't mean to minimize it at all. This is God's word. It's deeply important. But something's going on here that is, it's not, you know, we can't just read that and say, oh, yeah, of course. That's very clear and very emphatic very unambiguous. That's not the case here. And yet, it is what God is doing. And we talked a little bit about the whole idea of what, you know, prioritizing what's in the passage as we read things. What's the main part of the passage, or the main purpose of the passage? You know, our bent is to gravitate toward the things which are dramatic or unclear. Okay, I get that God's sovereign, so we can, you know, zip past that part and talk about, you know, the things that are really difficult and ambiguous. You know, keep the main, whatever you agree or disagree with me on, and whatever I present in this passage or any other passage, you know, what I want to be emphatic about is what's the main thing. Keep the main thing the main thing. Keep the secondary things secondary. Keep tertiary things tertiary. You know, emphasize what God emphasizes. What God emphasizes in the passage. So if you just take this passage as a whole, I'm not even going to, I'll read more of it in a moment, but you know, we've seen, we've got up on the board, vision of these beasts coming out of the ocean. Remember, I've written lion, bear, leopard, dreadful, and terror. They are like a lion, but there's things that are unlike a lion. We read about these things. We read about the horns coming up. We read about the fate of the beasts. What's the main thing? If you want to, you know, pull out the main thing out of the passage, what's, you know, how would you articulate that before we, you know, launch further into details? What's the main thing? Yeah, God's at work. You know, be not dismayed. saints, which is, by the way, that word saints is used over and over. You people of God, you holy ones, you set apart ones. We keep coming across that word in this passage. And, you know, dreadful things, you know, in some ways horrifying things are going to arise in human events, in the rise of nations. And all of this is in God's plan. It is serving his purposes. And I think one of the main features here, which we're going to elaborate a little more on today, is this court scene. We have the beasts. We have these dramatic visions, and as part of the vision, we have this prevailing over it all is a court. So let's read a little bit just in review. Visions of his head. I already mentioned that the four great beasts came up from the sea. Verse 3, verse 4. I'm not going to read the whole passage. I'm just going to allude to what we've already talked about and then try to move on from there. Four great beasts, verse 3, verse 4. The first was like a lion, and then it has details, but it stood like a man. It has wings. A man's heart was given to it. Verse 5, suddenly another beast, a second, like a bear with ribs in its mouth, between its teeth, devour much fleshes. It says, they said thus to it. That's interesting. Something, you know, they who? Well, I have to let that go because I don't think there's any elaboration on it. Verse 6, after this, I looked and there was another like a leopard, four wings of a bird, four heads, dominion was given to it. Verse 7, I saw in the night visions, behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. Now, the interesting thing is apparently all of these beasts would have been dreadful and terrible and exceedingly strong. So when it says dreadful and terrible, it's relative to the other four beasts, or the other three beasts, I'm sorry. It would seem to me as you're reading this, the others were okay. They were nice beasts. You know, this was a dreadful and terrible beast. Now, they're all, you know, from a human perspective, you know, I think it's very clear that they are dreadful. But this is even in comparison to the previous three, another order of magnitude of dreadfulness, I suppose you could say. It had iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it. It had 10 horns. As I was considering the horn, Daniel's just in this position of watching in God's providence. A little one coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots, and there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. So that's the vision. We've talked about what there's been a lot of consensus on, that if we compare it to Daniel chapter 2 especially, there seems to be a pretty close correspondence, and we know that the head of gold represented here by the lion, Babylon, the midsection of silver corresponded to by the bear is the Medes and the Persians. The bronze, which is corresponded to by the leopards, is Greece, which it's interesting that the leopard has four heads, and we've alluded to this before. I don't think we need to go deeply into it, but why do you think the four heads? What went on with the coming of the Greeks into history as this great and conquering beast?
Alexander died and his four generals.
Yeah, he divided his kingdom. He died without an heir and divided his kingdom between his four generals, two of which became the kingdoms of the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Two of those generals, I forget the actual names of the generals. It was Ptolemy, but the Seleucids came from another general. I don't recall his name. Lysandius, maybe. Anyway, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies were integral in the history of Jerusalem, of the Jews' dwelling place, and of the nation of the Jews. You know, the Ptolemies were originally given reign over that region. And then the Seleucids fought the Ptolemies. And so these are two Greek kingdoms descended from the Greeks that fought each other, and the Seleucids prevailed. And some of the greatest desecrations perpetrated on the Jews took place under the Seleucids. They defiled the temple, sacrificed Antiochus Epiphanes, one of the rulers of the Seleucids, sacrificed a pig on the temple at Jerusalem, deliberately scorning and provoking the worship of the true God as it was entrusted to the Jews. And the Jews went ballistic, and that was when the family of the Maccabees arose, Judas the Hammer. They revolted and threw off the yoke of the Seleucids and were independent for a time before the Romans came. And interestingly, at that time when the Maccabees arose against the Seleucids, there was a significant thread of thought amongst the Jews, probably represented historically in the Essenes, who sort of withdrew and went and lived in the wilderness apart from everybody. We always hear about the scribes and the Pharisees. They were competing parties that participated and derived their power from the Maccabean rebellion. There was a significant thread of thought amongst the Jews that they should not have rebelled against the Seleucids, that the whole Maccabean uprising, which gave us the intertestamental period and the Jews that Jesus ran into, there was a strong line of thought amongst the Jews that that should have never happened, that that was an illegitimate representation of Jewish government, because what the Jews should have been doing is simply waiting for God to send the Messiah, and every Jew simply should have been, you know, content under the rule and discipline of God's hands under these ungodly kingdoms and waited for God to sort it out by sending his Messiah. And so it is the people who were sort of the pragmatists who were saying, no, we're not going to wait for that. You know, we can't stand this. We can't have people sacrificing a pig on the altar. We're going to fight. And they were the ones that threw off the Seleucids, which sounds, you know, sort of in our American tradition of independence and taking care of ourselves, sounds very noble. But there were a lot of Jews which thought that was absolutely an ungodly thing to do, and the Jews shouldn't have done that. And interestingly enough, the descendants of those people are the ones that Jesus just had conflict with and was eventually murdered by, because and his whole idea of what the kingdom of God was supposed to look like was against what came out of that Maccabean rebellion. So that's very interesting, because Jesus is the one. He's the stone. He's the one bringing down the other kingdoms. You know, by the way, parallel in history, there's, you know, the ultra-Orthodox Jews today who still think that even national Israel established in 1948 is an unfaithful exercise by Jews who should simply be waiting for their Messiah to come and sort things out. So that's, go ahead. Yeah, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, both arose out of the Hasmonean dynasty, which arose out of the Maccabean rebellion. And both the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees were competing parties within the Hasmonean dynasty, who competed for influence to the point of civil war and fighting bloodily against each other, which, you know, we don't always pick that up in the New Testament. You know, that this wasn't Democrats and Republicans. This was bloody civil war. That's the relationship of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. But both of them arose out of the Hasmonean dynasty, which arose out of the Maccabean rebellion. So, and then, you know, what Scripture doesn't comment on is there were communities of Jews who just wanted to wash their hands of the whole thing and just, this isn't what we should be doing. So it's very interesting that that was the view of some of the Jews, and what came out of that whole episode, even though the independence sounds good, was a really perverted view of what it meant to be a Jew, to be a follower of the true God. Very pragmatic. So yeah, the Pharisees and the Sadducees were. Of course, you know, it's not like the next day. You know, several hundred years passed, but that was the origins of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. I mean, it's kind of interesting. You read the New Testament, if you've been reading the Old Testament, there's no mention of Pharisees and Sadducees, and all of a sudden, they are the representatives of the Jews. And, you know, what I think we're so used to hearing it, we never stop and think, well, where did they come from? Well, that's the answer. Yes, Keith. I'm not prepared to make a one-for-one comparison to the book of Revelation, but I do think, and we started down this road last week, Babylon comes up again in the book of Revelation. You know, I think that's, I don't tend to see, and this is where interpretation comes into it, I don't see these lives being prolonged as nations being preserved. It's their influence, the culture, what history has inherited. And I see Babylon very much representing riches. In Revelation, it's very clear that when Babylon falls, it's, you know, the traders and the kings saying, oh, Babylon the Great has fallen, and her merchandise is at stake here. That's very much the picture. Greece, you know, we talked about philosophy. Hold on, misspelling things there. And by the way, when I say philosophy, I don't mean like university formal philosophy. I just mean the ideas which influence how people see life. I'm looking at the clock and I don't want to get too far into this. But have you ever thought about how much Plato has influenced Christian thinking? There are Christians who have posited that Plato was sort of a proto-Christian. He didn't know about Jesus and the times, but he somehow God guided him into very Christian thinking. I don't think that's so at all, but Christians have said that because they have such a high regard for Plato. How many, you know, have sung sometime in your life, "This world is not my home, I'm just a passing through"? I would argue that that kind of thinking is right out of Plato, not the Bible. You know, there is a sense, of course, or it wouldn't be attractive to Christians. There is a sense in which we are simply passing through the world, but the Bible gives us really serious responsibilities and hopes for the world. You know, the idea that the body doesn't matter much; it's just what happens to the soul. Therefore, you know, what really matters is just getting through this and being saved and getting to eternity. That's as much Platonic as Christian thinking. Like I said, there's a sense in which your eternal being matters above your material being. That is certainly true. But God speaks in Scripture over and over very pointedly to our responsibility to be His image bearers in this creation. This is our mission field. This is not unimportant. This is not just something to grit your teeth and get through. You know, this is where we live, and where are we going to live for all eternity? That's not a rhetorical question. Yeah, the new earth, not heaven. Yeah, how many Christians, I mean, I think we have a little bit more literal or literate group here, but I think you stop the average Christian in the street and ask him, you know, what's going to happen to your soul for all eternity? Oh, I'm going to go to heaven. No, you're not. You are going to go to heaven, but that's temporary. The eternal state is a physical world in which you will live as a man or a woman. It's going to be different. It's going to be better. It is going to be glorified. But we're not going to be disembodied souls in heaven. Now, there certainly is a soul-body distinction, but it is Platonic or Platonic influence on Christianity, which has emphasized that so much that we see it like as two completely different things. Our bodies, you know, and this, you know, this world is just not much. It's just a, you know, the blink of an eye. Truth in that, but not to the degree that sometimes we allow it to be emphasized. It's serious business living as an image bearer. And this gulf and this divorce between the soul and body was something that Plato emphasized, and Christians picked up on, and they saw consistency with it in the scriptures. And, you know, we're right about that, but it gets overemphasized. The Christian view of man is, yes, you certainly have a soul and a body, and I'm not going to get into the debate whether we should divide ourselves three-way into soul, body, spirit, which is another discussion. But yes, it's true that you can talk about those categories, that our souls go on and when our bodies die. That is true. But the biblical conception of man is an image bearer where the soul lives in the body, and you are one person. Certainly a person who has a body and a soul, or to use C.S. Lewis's quote, which I love, is, you don't have a soul, you are a soul. You have a body. I love that. But you know, the biblical conception is that even though there is a difference and it's important, the goal is a united whole, a man. I'm using that in the generic sense, not the gender sense. But a man is an image bearer, a soul who lives in the tent, to use biblical language, of the body, but that's who he is, you know, a whole person that will forever be an image bearer. Anyway, so that's just one way in which Platonic philosophy or Greek philosophy has come down even to Christians. We could talk a lot about just view of life that we have inherited from the Greeks. Medes and Persians, what do you think, if there's this idea of their lives going on, what might you think of? I have an idea. I don't know that how much I can substantiate it. But if Babylon is clearly represented in commerce, we can so clearly see the Greeks bequeathing philosophy. In what sense do the Medes and the Persians go on? You know, referring to Verse 12, their dominion is taken away, yet their lives were prolonged. What does that mean? How were the Medes and the Persians prolonged?
They were great shipbuilders and war warriors.
Yeah.
So probably what they learned, Alexander might have picked up some of the techniques from that.
Yeah, certainly.
Certainly the Greek Navy was influenced by the Medes and Persians.
Certainly. I'm not running into this in a lot of commentaries, but my own, this is just an idea that's occurred to me. What's characteristic of the Medo-Persian Empire that we keep running into even in the book of Daniel? It causes a lot of problems. John?
Say their emphasis on law.
Law. Yeah. We look at our own form of government, and it is based on the whole idea that the law is above government. That government doesn't make laws, it serves higher law. And the laws that we make are supposed to be practical expressions of how we enforce things in society that are expressive of higher laws. This whole idea, you know, our political tradition in America is the Magna Carta. You know, the king has some higher principles. The king can't just do anything you want. The prevailing view for much of history was that the king was the final word. The king could do whatever he wanted. And the Magna Carta posited for the first time in a long time that, no, the king has some higher principles that reign over him, which he must serve. And that was more fully articulated if you read the writings of Samuel Rutherford, you know, lex rex, the law is the king. I'm teaching American history to my sixth graders, and I was just showing them a scene from a biographical film on John Adams. And he's confronted after the Boston Massacre. He's defending British soldiers, and everybody's, you know, in an uproar because he's on the wrong side, and he publicly stands in front of his house and says, his cousin says, this is a time for taking sides. Why aren't you on the side of the patriots? And he says, I am for the law. Everybody can see the nobility in that. The law is supposed to be served by government, not made by government. You know, the government doesn't give us rights. The government is supposed to protect rights, which our Declaration of Independence it says we receive because we are endowed by our Creator with them. Hope that sounds familiar to you. Where did that idea in history get started? Well, I'm not saying the Medes and the Persians get all the credit, and they were this great noble, you know, American-style republic. That certainly wasn't the case. But the idea that grew in history and has become central to the thinking of modern and postmodern governments, that the law is above any government. That's a pretty interesting manifestation of the Medes and the Persians. My purpose in sort of going through all these things is to try to articulate ways in which these kingdoms have continued their influence in ways that we should all identify with to some degree. I could have picked other examples, but we live in one of the most affluent societies in the world. What's going on even right now in our political system is that the progressive view of things is that the government is the system of experts upon whom we should all rely and defer to, and the conservative political thought, by the way, in history those two labels were reversed, but that's another discussion. The conservative thread of political thought is that we want to live in a nation under the rule of law, where government serves higher principles. We all live there. Greek philosophy has influenced the shape of our governments. It's even influenced some of the shape of Christian thinking. Augustine, who is very influential, obviously, in Christian thinking, was a student of Plato, very much a student of Plato. So these are all things that we can intuitively see how some of these threads have come down through history. Doesn't say the same thing about Rome, although it happens in a different fashion. The dreadful and terrible beast, I think there's general agreement that this is representing Rome and the empire spreading through the known world. And now we get to what's going on in the background. We've seen the beast rise through verse 8. We've even commented on the pompous words which one of the horns coming up out of Rome is speaking, and I'm purposely deferring comment on what the horns are. We'll come back to that. But read just verse 9 and 10 with me. Daniel's watching. He's seen the beast rise. He says, I watched till thrones were put in place, and the Ancient of Days was seated. His garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame, its wheels a burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. 1,000 thousands ministered to him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated and the books were opened. Skip down to verse 13, because we've already commented on what's the ongoing context that I think 11 and 12 looks at. I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed. So here's, look at the end of verse 10. This vision of the Ancient of Days and millions of servants before him. The court, it said, was seated. This is a judgment scene. A judgment scene. And then, as it proceeds, he's watching one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. What's that reminiscent of? Probably very prominent in people's mind. What, you know, what's that reminiscent of? Matthew 24. Right? You know, the Olivet Discourse, and Jesus talks about the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven. We tend to think of that, by the way, this might shake up your understanding of Matthew 24 a little bit, we tend to think of that as the second coming, but what's going on here? The Son of Man is coming on the clouds of heaven to the courtroom, to the Ancient of Days. He's coming to his Father for judgment. He's not coming to sort everything out in an immediate sense, in the second coming sense. By the way, I'm not going to delve into the significance or whether the parallel holds up in Matthew 24. I'll let you think that one through yourself. But this imagery of the Son of Man coming with the clouds, he's not, in this passage, coming to earth. He's coming to the judge. He's coming to the Ancient of Days, to God the Father. And he's coming for judgment to be pronounced. And the judgment that is pronounced is by the Ancient of Days, here's the scene. All the beasts are on the earth. The court is seated. The Ancient of Days is on the judgment seat. There's millions serving and ministering to him. The Son of Man comes before him. And what is the judgment that is pronounced? Again, not a rhetorical question. It's right there. What's the judgment that is pronounced? They brought him near before him. And the judgment pronounced is, you, Son of Man, are the King of the Kings and the Lord of the Lords. All dominion is going to be invested in you. Once again, reminiscent, if we're going to stay in Old Testament history and not go to the New Testament, we know the end of the story here. We know that Jesus Christ came as a man. But sticking with the context of Daniel, we're finding out what this stone is. It's the Son of Man, whose kingdom is forever, who brings down all the other kingdoms. All peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. Now, if you just read that language, it sounds like, great, God's going to bring his Son, he's going to crush all the other kingdoms, and everything's going to be, restored. God's representative, the Son of Man, this who the Jews would have clearly understood that he was talking about a Messiah. He's coming, and he's going to fix everything. And that does happen. But if you're just reading Daniel's words, and you're not getting the whole picture, it's really easy to think of this as a scene of conquest. And it is, but how does Jesus conquer? Well, he conquers by coming as a servant and suffering as a man and being triumphant over death by submitting to it. Very counterintuitive. But ultimately, that's the path to glory. Yes, Tim.
Well, I understand earlier you were talking about like a lion.
Right. Well, I'm kind of making a leap here because... My assumption that this is Christ is based on, and I am leaping ahead to knowing the end of the story as a New Testament believer, knowing who the one is to whom all dominion is given. You know, I know the end of the story here. So do I think Daniel would have understood that, oh, this is a picture of Jesus. This is God in the flesh. This is the one who's going to, you know, come and die on the... Daniel wouldn't have known any of this. I'm leaping to that with the hindsight that the New Testament gives me. As far as like a lion, like a bear, like a leopard, I'm not saying that what Daniel saw wasn't actually a lion, bear, leopard. I'm just saying that the language allows you to read it, that it's not exactly a one-to-one correspondent. You know, the lion has wings, stands up like a man. What kind of a lion does that? I'm not saying it wasn't a lion. The language of simile applies in both cases. But I'm not saying that these aren't, in Daniel's vision, actually a lion, bear, leopard. I'm just saying there seems to be more going on here. And I would say the same thing here. You know, like the Son of Man, well, what does that look like? Something greater than can be described. But he's the one to whom that the judgment is pronounced, that he gets all the authority. And so I'm interpreting that in the light of the hindsight that the New Testament gives me. Yes, Doug?
The ESV translates that there came one like a son of man.
Right. Right.
But he wasn't just any human being. So rather than saying he was like title, the Son of Man, he was like description of a human being.
Yeah.
But more than a human being. So it could be that rather than saying he was like Christ, saying he was like human.
Right.
And that doesn't mean he wasn't Christ. He wasn't just an ordinary human. I mean, he could be.
Yeah. Think of Nebuchadnezzar seeing the fourth man in the fire. I don't think it really changes the point of the story, but there's actually a lot of debate about what Nebuchadnezzar actually said there. Did he say, Son of God? Like, oh, God gave him revelation and he understood that Jesus was there with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fire? Or did he just say, the Son of God, meaning, oh, he revealed to me some idea of Messiahship and there's a great protector of the Jews? Or did he just see something that he had no idea how to express it, so the best that he could come up with was, it looked like the offspring of a god? Well, all of those are valid possibilities. I don't think it changes the point of the story. But yeah, same thing here. Could Daniel have been given some, you know, special revelation about, you know, what he was seeing that he just wasn't able to communicate clearly? I don't know, but I think it's as likely that he just said some magnificent man that deserves to be particular. He's not just a human, but he is a human. That's about as far as I can get with it. Newton, I see your hand. Right.
Human history has all gone awry. But in this day, it's going to be fixed. And one like the Son of Man will rule. And we know from the New Testament, of course, that's the Lord.
so he's also happens to be the Son of God as well. So I think that we have to keep that in mind, that he's fixing what was broken in Genesis early chapters.
Yeah. Think for a second of, and I can't bring the chapter and verse to mind. I think it was in Acts. Well, I'll have to look this up, but it just comes to mind. What was one of the things that was said of the early disciples of Christ as they were accused before Roman authorities? They were the ones who were doing what? Turning the world on its head. And that, because that's what it looked like. They're changing everything. They're flipping all the established order of things, when what they were actually doing is they were behaving as the representatives of this Son of Man who is actually taking an upside down world and turning it back to the way it was designed to be. You know, I think that's one of those incidents in Scripture, these men who are turning the world upside down, that is not just a careless idiom. I think that's recorded very deliberately, because that's exactly what it looked like, as they're turning the world upside down, when what they're actually doing is turning it back right side up. We're out of time, so this has to continue. We have the beasts, we have the court, we have the judgment pronounced. The beasts, through history, there's influence continuing, but their day is over. The Son of Man is the King of the Kings and the Lord of the Lords. That's the judgment of the Ancient of Days, and that's the main thing here. Now, we're about halfway through. I think 2 weeks, I think we can address what's going on, because Daniel, even though he's seen the vision and we've talked about it, he still is asking, what does this mean? And I'm not sure I'm going to, you know, clear all of that up, but you know, this is the vision. Now we're going to talk, you know, about, you know, some of the significance that I think that Newton has already commented on, and how that works out in detail. And we're going to comment on some parallel passage and finish this up. I'm planning 2 weeks, right? So. Didn't get as far as I hoped today, but the clock keeps moving. So thank you all, and we'll pick it up next week.